Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Jack McGuire, whose new book is Killing the Kingfish, The Huey Long Assassination. Jack McGuire served as Special Assistant to the Mayor of New Orleans, Press Secretary to the Mayor, and Director of Public Relations from 1964 to 1970, as well as Councilman-at-Large from 1984 to 2000. For more than 40 years, he was an officer of Union Savings and Loan Association in New Orleans. He is the author of Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah, and co-author with Walter Cowan of Louisiana Governors, Rulers, Rascals, and Reformers. Today, we're talking about his new book, Killing the Kingfish, The Huey Long Assassination, which weighs in at more than 3 pounds and more than 600 pages. Jack McGuire, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here again.
I see why it's been so long.
Yeah.
This is a must read for anybody who loves Louisiana politics. So tell us about your fascination with politics and what kept you interested in the Long family all these years.
From the time that I was a teenager, I was interested in following city and state politics. Mm-hmm. And my father had been one of the LSU Reveille 7 journalism students who had been expelled from LSU in 1934 for preparing to criticize the Kingfish in the student newspaper.
Wow.
They were getting ready to print a front page piece critical of his carrying on the campus with the football team and interfering with a great deal. Huey said it was his university. And my dad was making some dollars on the side as a correspondent for International News Service covering Huey, not only on the campus, but at the legislature. Mm-hmm. And the night before this issue of the Reveille was going to be distributed, Dad was sitting at the press box on the House floor in the legislature when a staff member from the university came in holding a big sheet of paper. And my father said, "Oh, my God, he's bringing an early copy of what's going to be on the front page tomorrow." And he watched. And Huey knew him from taking pictures of him on the campus.
Sure.
And everything else. And Huey walked over to him at the desk, balled up the tear sheet of the Reveille mm-hmm. in his face, in his hands, and threw it in my father's face and said, "Tomorrow you will not be a student at my university or any state college in Louisiana." And the next day, President Smith of LSU tried to calm Huey down. And finally, Huey said, for the 7 students and that were the core of it, he said that if they'll come to the Greek Theater on campus and appear before the student body and apologize to me, I might change my mind. But the boys weren't going to do that because the other condition was they had to agree to have a censor from the faculty. And whose job was to see that nothing critical of Huey Long appeared. So Dad was expelled. The University of Mississippi gave the 7 Freedom of the Press scholarships, and he graduated from there and then worked for a small paper in Hammond that was anti-Long, and he was the one reporter there for it. And after that, he went to the New Orleans State, said he was one of the reporters that covered the scandals of 1939-40 when so many members of the administration went to jail. But that, you know, always kind of starred me out. But then
I can imagine.
My father was involved in all of the anti-Long campaigns through the 40s and 50s. He became the first chief administrative officer of the city of New Orleans in Chep Morrison's administration. In 1959, I told him I wanted to go follow Earl Long around in that year's campaign where Earl was running for lieutenant governor. And he said, well, do that. You know, you've grown up with the Annie Longs. Go see the other side. And some years later, my book on that last campaign covered that. But from that point on, and I started, I'm a pack rat like my father was. And I collected anything on Louisiana politics, established a huge collection at the Louisiana Research Collection at the Tulane Library that has an enormous collection of political paraphernalia, photos, hand cards, everything in the world. And I acquired a large collection of very important Huey Long papers that I donated to it too. And so on and off over the years, when Sue and I moved to Mandeville and I was councilman at large there for four terms from 1984 to 2000. But, you know, I continued with all this collecting.
Yeah. It's hard to give up the habit once you start.
Then in 2017, I retired and my wife said I had to have a project now. She wasn't going to have me underfoot all the time. But at that point, I was finishing up with donating most of the rest of all of my political papers, both my father's and mine, to the Tulane Library. And I had a whole box where I'd put just about everything on the assassination that I had come across over all the years. And After looking at it again and then considering, and then I went back and read the four or five principal books on the assassination, and I said, you know, a lot of this is totally incorrect. They're repeating each other's errors. There's no investigation of the background of the sources to show that they would be reliable. And so I started with the idea of, well, let me see if I can do what would be the final book on the assassination. Final and would be my hope that after it, there would be no need for anything more. But at that time, too, the Tulane Journal did an article on my donation of the Huey Long papers there. And I got a call in my office downtown at a savings and loan by a fellow who said, I have some papers about Huey Long. Would you like to see them? I'm interested in selling them. And this guy came to my office, and I opened his briefcase, and he pulled out about a dozen files marked with State Bureau of Criminal Identification, Huey Long investigation. And they were what was not recovered in 1991-92 by the state when the gun that Weiss had was recovered, and some papers from the heir, the one surviving heir, daughter of General Gare, who was the head of the BCI, and he had mounted the investigation. And in 1991-2, once the gun and the papers were found, Dr. Weiss Jr. filed suit for possession of the gun, that he said it belonged to him now. It was his father's, it belonged to him. The state stepped in, and the state police and the state archives said, no, the gun and any papers relating to the investigation belong in the state archives on that. So there was a great deal of controversy on that. The state police reopened the investigation, and after a lengthy investigation, Lieutenant Donald Morrow of the state police, who headed it, concluded that he had found nothing that would conflict with the general position at the time that it occurred that Dr. Weiss went there. He had no confrontation or anything with Huey. He just pulled his gun and shot him. And then the bodyguards, you know, filled Weiss full of bullets. But the papers that I had acquired went beyond the DeSoto Hotel conference 2 months before the assassination, when about 200 Annie Long leaders from throughout the state got there, met there to get a ticket put together for the 1936 state election.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack McGuire, whose new book is Killing the Kingfish, The Huey Long Assassination. We talk about political violence now as if it were contemporary only, but you describe in that chapter confrontations and altercations, this climate of political violence where people were saying openly the only way to deal with Huey Long was to kill him, or someone should take a bullet to Huey. And it was just spoken about in casual conversation by men and women.
My father told me anytime you had more than three people together and Huey Long came up, one of the three said he's got to be killed. Quite truthfully, my father said, because Huey had been providing as governor and then now with O.K. Allen, his stooge is the governor. I mean, he was building hospitals, roads, trade schools, university campuses, and pulling Louisiana out of the mud and providing so many public services and projects that prior to Long, the old Bourbon alliance of the planners with the New Orleans ring, the old regulars, wasn't interested in doing a lot of public improvements, improving schools or anything else. And my father said it was just common.
So
and
do he you said think that was a forerunner of things to come.
Well,
or do you know?
Yeah, it could be. Because my father's view of it was, he said, and my father said, I thought all along that eventually someone was going to kill him because that was the only way that his regime would be ended. And he said, every time people would say someone should kill him, and he always wondered who would be the person, you know, who might do that. And Dad said quite honestly, as I've said at the time, the problem in dealing with Huey Long was that his opponents were opposed to everything he did, good or bad. Uh-huh. And they never, and for years afterwards, they never, you know, always campaigned against the Longs, always tried to revive the scandals. And Dad said when Huey Long was shot, that was the only way he was going to leave the political scene in Louisiana, because he was going to win every election, you know?
Tell that story about Uly Burke, the tax assessor.
Yeah. Huey had an alliance with the old regulars and Mayor Sims Walmsley in New Orleans on and off. But then in 1934, they had a break over the city election when Walmsley was a candidate for re-election. And Huey said he was going to support him only if Huey could name several of the ticket members, the DA, couple of judges and everything else. And Walmsley would not agree to that. And Huey then put his own ticket in the and allied with some of the old regular opponents. And among the old regular leaders was a tax assessor from the 3rd Municipal District named Ulick Burke. And he was a no-holds-barred guy himself. And Huey would get it. Huey had a recording studio in his suite at the Roosevelt Hotel.
Yeah.
He would sit and speak for hours, and he would sing, and it was just incredible what he would do. And he really took after the old regulars and went down a list name by name. He attacked Ulick Burke as a no good on, you know, everything he could think of. And Ulick Burke called him at the Roosevelt and got put through to him and remonstrated to him about what he had said. And he dared him to repeat it to his face. And Huey said, I'll repeat it right now on the air. And Ulick Burke said, well, then just stay where you are, because I'm coming to see you.
Challenging him to a duel,
He went to the Roosevelt Hotel. Two or three of the bodyguards let him in. Since he was a big elected official in the city, they didn't search him or pat him down. And Healy Burks said, challenged him to a duel. And he said, I'm not going to fight with you. I'll have one of my boys do that. And Healy Burks said, and they went back and forth. But then finally, Healy apologized to him. And he said, you're not nearly as bad as the rest of that bum group. And as Healy Burks got up to leave, and Healy rose from their seats alongside him, Healy Burks handed him a bullet.
A single bullet.
Yeah. And Healy looked at it, and he said, what is this? He said, it's what I would have put in you if you hadn't apologized to me. And he said, how would you have done it? And he said, Healy, I have a gun in each pocket. And all of a sudden, the bodyguard, and Healy said, no. And Healy Burks put his hands on the pockets of his suit coat, kind of held it up. You saw there was something in there. And Healy said, would you have used that? He said, yeah, if you hadn't apologized to me, and I'll use it if you act like that to me again. So Healy Burks was then escorted out by the bodyguards. But interestingly, this was an instance where Healy, by the time he was in his second year as governor, was paranoid about assassination. He'd been impeached and then had beat impeachment by getting the majority needed in the Senate to agree not to move to a court on impeachment. So the impeachment fell apart. But he started having these bodyguards.
They emerge as fascinating characters.
Yeah, they really are. And one of the interesting things, though, and was one of the problems which I have of the people and the writers and commentators who say, well, Weiss only punched Huey and then the bodyguards panicked and opened fire. Mm-hmm. In all of my research on confrontations Huey had, people throwing rotten tomatoes and eggs at him, trying to get up on the stand, a platform to attack him, trying to punch him, anything else. Not once did any of the bodyguards pull a pistol. They used their fists, they used their blackjacks, they knocked someone down and drag them off. So I have a real problem with saying that they would panic. And actually, one of the important things about that is that all of the five books on the assassination say that the bodyguards were bums, untrained, they weren't marksmen, they didn't know what they were doing, that type of thing. And the fact of the matter is that they were all marksmen, they were all law enforcement men. One of them, Elliot Coleman, had become a deputy sheriff when he was 17 in 1899, continued as a law enforcement officer, killed several men in altercations, became a member of the BCI, the
Bureau of Criminal
he put at least 3 to 4 bullets in Weiss when he came running up the hall to confront him.
And who was it who said Huey was hard to be a bodyguard for because he was always on the move?
Yeah. And later, after the assassination, he was elected to 6 terms as sheriff of Tensaw Parish. Mm-hmm. 4 other bodyguards were sheriffs of their parishes. Others, 3 became chiefs of police in Louisiana cities. 4 of them became superintendent of Louisiana State Police, 2 under 2 different governors. 1 of them was Louisiana's highest decorated soldier in World War I, and another for 8 consecutive years had won the marksmanship trophy for the Caddo Gun Club. So they were all. And as you indicated, one of the real problems, with it, and Murphy Roden, Huey's principal bodyguard, you know, had said that what concerned us the most was he moved too fast. Huey moved at such a fast pace. And in fact, when Huey was shot outside of the governor's office, he had left the House chamber. Murphy Roden was alongside him. They went to the governor's office. Murphy rode and followed him into the governor's office. Huey just shouted, "We're going to have a conference tomorrow morning to look over the agenda for the day," and immediately turned around, leaving the governor's office, and almost ran into Roden as he went into it to follow him.
Wow.
And Roden then had to catch up to him in the, you know, in the corridor. But he did, you know, he was very, very quick on his feet.
You have such a thorough and interesting approach. You go through archive by archive and major book by major book and point out the flaws and the successes in the ones that are worthy. And you also go document by document. And one of the more interesting documents to me was the mortician's tale about Merle Welsh at the Rabbit Horse Funeral Home.
Yeah, the Rabbit Horse Funeral Home that took care of both bodies, both Weiss and Huey Long. And the difficult thing about that, Merle Welsh was the mortician there and was with the funeral home and, in fact, then owned it and then sold it and then started another funeral home. And he was quite a character himself. And later, he served for 20 years on the State Board of Education, elected from his congressional district, which was a very important position. But 50 years after the shooting, Merle Welsh told Ed Reed, who did a book called Requiem for a Kingfish, Strange and Unexplained Assassination of Huey Long. He interviewed Merle Welsh, who was really up in years there. And Welsh said that that night, while he was getting ready to embalm Huey, Dr. Clarence Lorio came there and opened the surgeon's incision in Huey's abdomen and put his hand in there, rooting around inside the cadaver, and came out with a bullet that was obviously larger than what a Weiss's .32 caliber would have been. And that Lorio put it on a tray then next to the body and left. And when he departed, Weiss told his assistant, Jack Unbehagen, that he could keep the bullet. And he, you know, Welsh maintained this was absolutely true, and that you had to believe what Welsh said, and that's exactly what happened there. And that's not at all what happened there. You know, Dr. Lorio did not have to come to the mortuary. He was already there. He had not left Huey's body from the time it was moved to the from Our Lady of the Lake Hospital to the mortuary. And he accompanies Huey's body there with Earl Long. The last thing that Clarence Lorio, and none of them got into this who accepted Ed Reed's story on this interview with Merle Welsh. The last thing Clarence Lorio would have wanted to do was to find a large caliber bullet in Huey. And because the Weiss had a .32 and the bodyguards had .38s and .45s, which if there was a large caliber bullet there, that meant one of them had shot Huey.
Well, this is just exactly the kind of detail you read this book for.
Yeah.
This is just, there's so much fascinating stuff. We've been talking with Jack McGuire, who has done a lot of work in killing the kingfish, the Huey Long assassination. You can meet him Monday, May 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Bring your questions and queries. Jack, thank you so much. It's been a complete pleasure.
Oh, I'm delighted.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. The People's Program's Poetry Class presents its 14th annual event, a poetry reading by Louisiana Poet Laureate Gina Ferrara, Sunday, April 26th at 2 p.m. at 2240 Lakeshore Drive, New Orleans. Best-selling author Max Brawlier discusses and signs The Last Comics on Earth, Across the Doodleverse, Monday, April 27th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. Chandrani Ghosh debuts her novel Heartlines Monday, April 27th at 6 p.m. at the Garden District Bookshop. Laura Brill Sullivan celebrates her debut poetry collection, Sailing with Angels, Wednesday, April 29th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Karina Brown discusses and signs The Battle for the Black Mind, Thursday, April 30th at 6 p.m. at Baldwin & Company. Sue Diego discusses and signs Doulos, A New Way to Move Through Change, Thursday, April 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jack McGuire discusses and signs Killing the Kingfish, The Huey Long Assassination, on Monday, May 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And April 25th is the 13th Annual Independent Bookstore Day. Visit New Orleans Independent Bookstores for a citywide literary crawl with a chance at the grand prize and gift cards for those who visit and get their IDB passport stamped at all 11 participating New Orleans Independent Bookstores, including Octavia Books, Baldwin & Company, Blue Cypress Books, Community Bookstore, Frenchman Art & Books, Garden District Bookshop, Tubby & Coos at the Good Shop, Crescent City Books, Faulkner House, Nomad Books, and Parlor Books. This year, the New Orleans Crawl will take place over a 9-day period from Saturday, April 25th to Sunday, May 3rd. One lucky winner will win a gift card from each of the participating stores. Pick up your passport starting on Independent Bookstore Day at any of the participating bookstores, get it stamped at each stop along the way, and turn it in at your last stop. You may also be collecting other goodies along the way to be determined by each store.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.